the houses that survived the, you know, the tornadoes and the earthquakes and the hurricanes, the gas, are the ones with the strongest and deepest foundations. And in our business, foundation is based on data and trust. I mean, it is mixed together like concrete and sand. And if you don't have one, the other one's no good to you. And you can have all the data in the world, or if the client doesn't trust you.
The heart of advice. It's personal. It's pragmatic. Here on the eMoney Heart of Advice podcast, we explore how to navigate both sides to help you take your financial planning practice to the next level. Join us as we speak with financial professionals to learn how they deepen relationships and improve client outcomes. This podcast contains purely educational information, and nothing discussed may be construed as legal, tax, or financial advice. Please consult a financial advisor for any financial investment or money management questions. All views or opinions represented are solely the opinion of the speaker and do not represent those of eMoney Advisor or any of its affiliates or subsidiaries.
Welcome to the Heart of Advice podcast, presented by eMoney. I'm Sasha Grobbenstetter.
And I'm Connor Sung. We're your eMoney experts. Today in the podcast, we have James Werner. James, first off, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Of course.
Of course. James is a certified financial planner. He's a partner and wealth advisor at Waverly Advisors, located in Austin, Texas. He's an alum of University of Texas at Austin. He has over 25 years of experience, and he's an eMoney user since 2006. So, I mean, let's just start there. Thank you for your long tenure of eMoney usership.
Mm-hmm. I think that might make me an eMoney OG, so I'll go with that.
We love that. James, as we get started with the podcast, I want to know what inspired you to pursue a career in financial planning, and how has the field kind of evolved since you've started? I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, so a couple of things for me kind of stood out. When I was growing up, we had a kind of a lower income class environment that we never were, you know, short of money, but we weren't talking about investing or anything like that. My mom would always get very, very anxious around when taxes came due or when bills came due. It was very much, finance was very much a source of just anxiety and uncertainty around the house. So, you know, not wanting to kind of rebelling against your parents by, you know, understanding something they didn't understand might be part of it. And then I think the other part of it for me is I was privileged to be able to work with a gentleman when I was in high school who owned his own business and gave me kind of a meaningful role in his organization, developing an educational program for children in daycare centers that were working through it. And I was just in awe of how much that guy worked and how much he knew about his business model. And unfortunately, he knew so little about finance that it really hamstrung him. And so when I went to the University of Texas, I thought, well, I have some of those abilities. I have some of that. And so maybe I can do all that stuff and, you know, learn a little bit about finance. And so I worked like two or three jobs when I was in high school, and, you know, one of the jobs was vending at the Ranger games. So I would get a lot of cash tips. And so I would go, you know, sometimes I would maybe go 2 months without cashing a paycheck because I had enough walking around money. And I was a little concerned about my mom, you know, taking some of my paycheck. So if I hit it, you know, it might stay around a little bit longer. And I ended up kind of going into that mindset and kind of taking a left turn and going into Fidelity instead of a right turn and going into the bank. And that's kind of what hooked me to, hit me to investments. So, you know, kind of a different, maybe a different path, but that's kind of where it all started.
I think for so many young professionals now, James, and I don't know how often you see young professionals, but they always say like, this is a helping profession and that's why they get into it. And it kind of sounds like that's a little bit of what you did as well. So I'm sure that our advisors can definitely relate to some of that.
Yeah, I didn't quite know what I was getting into until I got ready to graduate from school, and I thought, man, I got to go out and find a job. What's going on? And I really kind of understood how finance, once you started looking for work and internships and things like that, then you kind of start learning how the business separates itself. And until then, you're just all kind of taking the same classes and you tell everybody you're in finance and you really don't know what you're talking about. But I would say that today's generation knows a lot more, a lot earlier than I did. They're much more clued into what the potential track would be for a potential career, things like that. I find that the average person, average college age or recent graduate that I talk to is much more clued into industry opportunities and career path and stuff like that than I ever was. So that's good.
It is. And I think it speaks a lot to the changing environment. Both, I think the profession has definitely changed itself, but the way that we're training the next generation of advisors has also changed, I think, for the best, to help mirror some of the evolution of the advice that's being delivered, or even just the value of the advisor, I think has continued to shift a little bit. How do you, as you think about, you know, over 25 years of experience, what keeps you kind of engaged and passionate about helping clients?
Well, I mean, I get engaged with solving the problem and all the different tools and things that are available now, and trying to stay up to date as best I can with technologies and tools of today, and not be that guy who's still doing the same thing they did 20 years ago and trying to justify it. So I would say that's a part of it. But I would also say that for most people that are in personal financial planning, I mean, once you bring a new family into your company, I mean, you're adding this, you know, layer to your ecosystem that just kind of, that relationship just grows over time. So what starts out as a very, you know, transactional financial relationship morphs into something that's quite a bit different from that. And so I guess the industry and the changes that are happening, and more importantly, I guess the people that are presenting those changes, that gives me a lot of motivation. But it's that responsibility, and it's that shared journey that you're kind of going on with every family and every household that you take on, that really is the thing that makes it hard to say no or hard to put.
Get that mental currency, that mental gratification. I think that coincides with your personal business. And as I think about some of the other shifts in the industry, there has been a great feeling of, you know, acquisitions and mergers that has definitely changed the way that I think that we're able to deliver advice, either through our own businesses, through other businesses. Can you talk a little bit about some of the lessons you've learned, either from, you know, co-founding Silicon House Wealth Management or now as a partner at Waverly?
Yeah, sure. I think that one of the things I would have gone back and told my earlier self, you know, we always say if you could go back 10 years ago and tell yourself different things, what would you do? I would say you really need to start thinking about how you're going to sell or merge your business a lot earlier than you wanted to. It really should inform almost every decision you make, from founding to when you actually have, well, that merger. And I found that I find a lot of businesses, not just in financial planning, but when you start talking about due diligence phases after, you know, after offer letters have been issued and accepted and things like that, you see people going through the financials and go, oh, well, I did that because of this, or I did that because of that. And ultimately they're saying, I did that because I was only thinking about the moment. I wasn't thinking about how that would impact, you know, longer term. And I think one of the things that helped us in our relationship with eventual merger with Waverly was how many tools and how many service concepts we already had in common. So we were already kind of speaking the same language before we started. But it was at the end of the day that the culture of their firm matched more closely to the existing culture that we had developed. And so when I'm thinking about, if I'm giving advice to somebody who's in a smaller practice, and, you know, maybe they're going to continue on with that smaller practice, but maybe they're open-minded to joining a larger practice, you know, I would very strongly recommend three things. I would say, prepare your business today like you were going to sell it tomorrow. I would say think about the impact of whatever you do on your main stakeholders. It's your employees, it's the owners of the company, and it's your clients. If you make whatever decision you make, who ends up, where do the consequences end up? Do all the benefits end up in the owner's lap and all the consequences go to the employees and the clients? If that's the case, you probably don't have a good way forward. And I guess the third thing I would say is, when you think about things like e-money, e-money is great because it's this receptacle of all the knowledge, all the financial knowledge you have about a client, right? So you got a big decision that's coming up and you're thinking, well, in almost every big decision, you're thinking, well, does it match their cult, their values? Is this something these people should be doing just by itself, right? And then the second thing is that capacity to do it. Do they even have a chance to look at this, right? And so those are the first two things that we're always kind of going through. And as you're going through those big decisions, most people get, well, they focus very narrowly on some bucket or some financial concept, and they have a hard time stepping back and seeing the big picture. When the market's down, they're focusing on their account that's down the most. When they've got to make some college funding, or when they have an unusual expense that comes up, they start looking at how much money they're making on their cash management account. When they get a bad diagnosis, they're looking at their estate plan in a different way than they might have been looking at it before. And so you've got all these things that you've, all this history that you've put into the system, and you don't know when it's going to be required to spring to action. You don't really have control over that in some ways, but you always have that backdrop of, like, how do you prep your clients for the storm, right? And I was always thinking that the houses that survived the tornadoes and the earthquakes and the hurricanes, the guests, are the ones with the strongest and deepest foundations. And in our business, foundation is based on data and trust. I mean, it is mixed together like concrete and sand. And if you don't have one, the other one's no good to you. And you can have all the data in the world, or if the client doesn't trust you, it's not going to be a great relationship. So just to tie a bow around that, so as you're building up that ecosystem within eMoney, and as you're bringing that foundation to a good place for all of your clients, what you're also doing is you're building a foundation to present to somebody else to say, hey, here's what my business really is. And, do I have a home in this larger organization? What am I bringing to the table and what am I getting? I mean, at the end of the day, we're both better off if this is a good transaction. So tell me why that is. So, and I think you can prepare for doing that without, admitting to the world and the universe that you are doing that. I think even if you never sell, preparing to sell is the right thing to do for everybody this year.
It's a really good concept to be thinking of, especially in the environment that we are in right now. And you're talking a little bit about client trust, but I want to know, like, how did you tell your clients about this merger and how did they feel about it? Did you, like, tell us the process of the merger and telling clients?
Yeah. So again, you go back to, okay, how is this going to affect the client? And so since we have custodial accounts at the same custodians that our clients do, we have our own e-money accounts that we manage, and we have all this stuff going on for us. And we said, I mean, really, I'm just a client that doesn't pay an advisory fee. I should have the same experience as all the other clients, right? And so if you look at it from that standpoint, you go, what does this mean to me? Well, we were going to be at the same custodian. We were going to have the same e-money platform. There weren't a lot of things that were going to change. The compensation system wasn't going to change. We had already all kind of settled on how our investments were going to be allocated and some of the changes there. And so it was really more, ultimately, I think the client question that I had the most is, okay, if nothing's going to change, why are you doing it? Which I think is a great question, right? Because we kind of walk into this stuff and we go, well, if it's really easy on a client, then they shouldn't have any objections. Why, or what's the difference? And the other way to look at that is, well, okay, if you're not changing anything, why are you still, what's going on? And so that really made me think about it a little bit deeper and think about, well, right now we've got, you know, access to, you know, three people, you know, three advisors who work really hard to try to find me the answers to everything. But wouldn't it be nice if you had three too? And wouldn't it be nice if you had a whole department that was, you know, geared toward retirement plans? And, you know, wouldn't it be nice if you had just the ability for somebody to take a vacation or take an unscheduled absence and you didn't feel like 25% of your workforce was gone, right? And so those were the real world kind of answers to that. And the second part of it is you grow only so far as you can grow in your current ecosystem. And you kind of have to break out of that shell, just like a bird has to crack out of the egg, right, before it can grow. I think every business kind of has that. I know Michael Kitsis has done a boatload of stuff on this, showing, you know, the different stages of advisory firms and how no matter how efficient you are, you run into that roadblock. And you either get really happy with being that kind of firm and you just enjoy it, or if you want to grow, you have to kind of break out of that shell and do it. But to answer your question, along that was the thing. It was look at it from a client's perspective and then be really cognizant of what your client feedback is, because a lot of times they're going to give you the unvarnished smartest thing that you can think of, but you never would have even thought of, well, okay, maybe I'm going to answer the alts.
But it sounds like you took the time to really understand what the client was thinking. And I think that's really important, especially when you're selling your business. So you're right. Like that fear from a client of like, well, what's going to change? I could totally understand that. So it's scary for the client. It's also scary for you, but you were ready. And I think that they appreciated probably that transparency that you gave them.
Well, and they knew how poorly I was at managing things that weren't, you know, financially related. So yeah, any kind of merger that would let me do more planning and less, you know, HR was probably a good thing.
I just wanted to compliment you on just kind of the perspective there, that it definitely asking that question, what is it going to change for my clients? And also just, as you know, building your own e-money portal is the first recommendation we make. Like, make your own plan, build your own portal, play around with it, build your own, you know, connections, and so that you can understand the barriers, the questions that you're going to end up having to answer on behalf of your clients. But then as you think about, back to the question, the overall process, like the whole thing, does it make more sense for you where you were at the time to go out and sit down and interview a bunch of people to try and grow to the capacity level that you needed in order for you to focus more on what you wanted to do and where you ultimately delivered the most value, which ended up being, you know, that Waverly was perfectly aligned as far as the way that you were supporting clients and some of the technology that you were already using and a lot of the, I guess, like overall methodology and values perspective, where adding capacity by merging with Waverly, I think ultimately brought you to where you wanted to be personally. It also helps your staff, which I think ends up being a more of a transitory positive client experience for your clients that you brought along with you versus actually having like an immediate kind of feeling of a different tech or a different advisor, a different planner that they're interfacing with.
Yeah, I think, I guess the best way I could put it is if our practice was more niche oriented, when you think about that, I mean, if you're only doing one thing and you're doing it really, really well, then you can do it for a lot of people. And so those type of businesses are just absolutely destined for organic growth. that was never my, that was never my value add. That was never my strong suit, was to be able to focus on one thing. I was always kind of ADD and not able to stay out of any part of, you know, somebody's business. So, you know, we would be in the cash management, the estate planning, the retirement planning, we'd be all over the place, tax planning. And so, when you're doing that kind of work, I think you're limited to the number of households that you can service and serve well. And so part of the merger, when you think about merger, it's not really about growing so much. It's about finding a home for all those clients that you're not willing to serve, because we have a capacity problem in this business. We do not have a problem of, you know, financial advisors not having enough clients. I'm sorry, that does not exist. What we have is we have a problem of people that wanting financial advisors being able to find them under a service model that fits their needs, you know, regardless of what their underlying financial, you know, wherewithal looks like. We have a problem with that. And so for me, every hour that I was spending on HR, I know I, you know, kind of included it earlier, but I mean, every hour that I was spending doing something other than financial planning or management was an hour that I was kind of stealing from myself that I could have been using in the first place. So my biggest barrier to growth or personal growth was myself, was not wanting to release control over that. And I, you know, there's another partner here, Tom Brown, who's probably going to laugh when he hears this, because I mean, he does 90% of it. I only did like 10, and still, I think my 10% cost us to, you know, even more time than we use. But the point is, when you're bringing your stuff, when you're merging with another entity, hopefully you can offload. I mean, we've offloaded all of our HR stuff. We've offloaded headache after headache after headache. It's not that they don't get addressed. It's just that they don't take, you know, our time. And so now we've freed up more time to work with clients. And so that's how we grow. And, you know, so there's different ways to, I guess there's different ways to label growth, and there's different ways to think about it. But I think for me, when I think about growth, I think about how much of my time can I spend doing what I want to do and what I'm good at during the day versus the alternative. And that's definitely grown. So that's growth enough for me, I guess.
But it sounds like you get to do what you're really good at and what you want to do. So I think that's a win for you, ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, on most days it feels like it. Today notwithstanding, but it does definitely feel like it.
I do want to ask a little bit about your clients and making sure that you kind of reach their, not only their values, but their goals, and making sure that that approach is aligned with each of them. So how does that look when you're working with clients, that value alignment, making sure the goals are unique for them?
Yeah, I think that's, I guess the best way I can describe this, it's kind of a multi-tier process. And then so you start off and you make all those assumptions on what goals are, what your starting position is, what your client's feelings toward money are and about money. Are they products of a household that had a good relationship with money or not? There's all kind of things like that happen. And when you start off working with a client, it's a lot like a first date. I mean, the client wants to be on their best foot and you want to be, you know, the prim and proper advisor. And so, you know, you get about 2-3 months into this thing before you really realize, oh, you know, they're a real person with some imperfections here. They haven't done everything they were supposed to do. And then they realize that you're just kind of a human person and not a robot. So y'all can just kind of talk together. And I think that's really when you start getting that relationship that has some meaning. And when I talk about that, I mean, as an advisor, you ought to be able to push back on your clients. Because if all you're ever doing is just agreeing with whatever your client's ideas are, then you're not serving as an advisor. And so the ability to push back and motivate in that way is super important. And I think if you're I think you should look at every relationship you have and say, do I have the ability to deal? And that's a great barometer on how good that relationship is. And then on the other side of it, you have to be organized enough from a data standpoint and have a staff that's committed enough to know what are the areas where you need to pull the client forward. What are some of the things that they're not doing that they would never do if they were by themselves, but you need to make sure that they address? I mean, do they have an estate plan that makes any sense? Have they really looked at their estate? Do they really know from a dollar standpoint who's going to get what, who's going to control what? Have they thought about the worst case scenario? Have they thought about how these things are going to go? Those sorts of things. Because what I always find, you know, you talk about how you talk about how do you talk to clients during the storm, you know, during the when the market's falling, you know, 20% in 6 months, or when they just lost their job, or when there's some negative dynamic change in their lives, how do you talk to clients? Well, the thing is, it's how you talk to them before that happens that's the point. It's how you set the table. It can be very, I think it's almost, it's really hard as an advisor not to fall into this trap where if a client's having a really good income year or a really good investment year, that you don't take that step back and go, hey, here's what everything looks like from the 10,000 foot level. Because if you don't do that, everything's good and it's going to be a quick meeting and it's going to be a fun meeting and it's going to be a good meeting. But you don't get the chance to step back and go, you know, we've talked about, you know, 20% of your assets here. The other 80% are over here and they're kind of doing the same thing they were 2 years ago. So let's not get too excited over the, over the performance of this small account. Right? And so then if you're constantly doing that, if you're constantly being the wet blanket when all the client wants to do is celebrate, and you're constantly being the optimistic figure when the client just wants to be miserable, then that's how you maintain that balance. And you just have to do that, because over time, what happens is we all get recency bias. We all worry more about what's happening in the current and project that forward, much more so. And it causes us to change our plans, defer our plans, causes us to ignore otherwise rational advice that we've already kind of put in place. And I think it starts with not how do you deliver bad news, but it's how do you manage good news into that inevitable period where you have to deliver bad news. And I think if you do the one thing, the former thing well, the other thing is easier. If you never get bad news, if you only get good news, and then good luck. I mean, it's just not easy to make that transition. But that's how I think about it. I mean, I'm sure every advisor has a little different take on it, but I feel pretty strongly about that when I'm going into a meeting that I know is going to be really, really strong, not because of anything I did, but just because the environment as a whole was, the client's doing great at work or whatever, right? If I know that, I start looking for things that I can pick. I start looking for things that we're not accomplishing that we should be. Because that's the perfect time to introduce.
Yeah, give them a good flavor of both so that they stay level-headed throughout. And like you mentioned, I think everybody's got their own approach to doing that via, expectations, like very clear and repetitive expectation setting, or if it is a little bit of the good and the bad in pretty much every opportunity. I do want to pivot a little bit. As a longtime user of eMoney, if you weren't aware, eMoney is celebrating our 25th anniversary this year. Do you remember when you first started using it?
Yeah, I mean, we were on the program in 06. I would say we were great users of it would be an exaggeration. In 2007, I sold half of my business to a client of mine, Tom Brown, who's now the other managing partner, and then still with us. And Tom was very well versed on technology. I was not. And it's as hard a thing as it is to sell half your baby. I mean, when you realize you have that real limitation and somebody else has that skill set. So that happened in 2007. And I think we probably, over the course of 07 to 09, onboarded pretty much everyone until on the platform.
What do you think the most impactful piece of the platform is that has evolved the most since you started using?
Decision Center is probably easily number one. I know when I was on the e-money advisory platform, we met in those first meetings in Radnor. I mean, there were a lot of people that wanted to give the client the digital whiteboard so that they could play around. We heard that concept all the time. Let's let the clients play around. Let clients play around. And there was a section of advisors that said, the clients don't know what they're doing. Let's not let them play around. But the idea behind that, there was such a thing in place at the time where if you made a change to the program, it kind of made a change to the plan, and you weren't able to just kind of, in a low pressure environment, put a change in there and this, oh, forget that. We'll go to something else, right? Well, the Decision Center lets you do that, right? It's like this virtual whiteboard in the sky that you just draw things on. And then when something clicks, you go, oh, well, let's add that to the plan. That's kind of cool. That works for us. That's the single biggest thing. I think for my purposes, what I find myself using is probably, it used to be the distribution center is what they used to call it. But now it's just the estate planning module of the Decision Center. But I'll say this, I think that piece of the puzzle solves more problems for my clients than any one thing. Because when you think about it, when people put their last will and testament or trust together and things like that, and they think about how that legacy is going to transition over to the next generation, right? They always think in terms of their wealth. Here's my pie of wealth. And yeah, my son John's going to get a third, my daughter's going to get a third, and I'm going to give a third to charity. And so they think about that and it makes sense to them. And then when you run that distribution center or the estate planning calculation, and they see the amount of money that one third of their estate is, then they start thinking, well, I'm not sure Johnny's ready to handle that. Maybe tell me about those trusts again. You know, tell me about, and wow, that's a lot of money. That's more money to give to that organization than I thought. Tell me about how I can, you know, set up a small IRA and list them as beneficial. It sparks more conversations and more aha moments than any other thing that I do, because the Decision Center, when you think about it, is a very forward-looking instrument, right? You're always saying, here's where we are and here's where we're going. The distribution or the estate planning center is, if I died tomorrow, this. And man, that gives some urgency to people. Because if you look at that screen and it says, if I died tomorrow, Johnny's getting $1 million more than he should be getting with no guidance, and I can't let that happen. You know, I can't in good conscience let that happen. And so I think there are things in our industry that are designed to be decisions made in percentage terms that when you look at them in dollar terms, they look totally different. And the ability to do that is, I'm never surprised at how much that, you know, impact somebody. I think the third thing I would say is, you know, there's 1,000 different reports that you can get through e-money, but there is a personalization of a report. There's a concept where a client is going to hit on one or two reports and they're going to go, oh yeah, that's my report. They won't even list it like, you know, they won't even call it the name of the report. It's just, have you got my report ready? Have you put my report into the portal? Is my report ready? And so that's a test on two fronts, right? It's a test on, number one, do we know what their report is,
right?
Do we know their situation well enough to know what their report is without having to ask them? So that's a good thing. And then the second thing is, how did they take ownership of it? Well, they probably had three or four different reports that we'd been going through, and at some point they settled on. And so the ability to kind of go into their individual site, how they look at the e-money world, and favorite the reports that are really their reports and let the other reports go into the background is super
helpful.
Because no two clients pick the same report. If they all did, it'd be easy and we just had two reports, that'd be it. But they all have different, different reports. But if you've got somebody who has a report that they really kind of get a lot of benefit out of, let's say the five-year cash flow report is something a lot of our business owners really like. They don't really believe in looking forward farther than 5 years because the future's too uncertain. But they want to look at it in a little more detail about just a graph or a line drawing, or things are going to be good, or your wealth is going to go from the left to the upper right hand corner. It's going to grow over time. They want to see what makes that wow. Where are you projecting my earnings to be? Where are you projecting the taxes to be? What's the expenses? What are the one time expenses? All those things that five-year and shows are all. And so clearly when you factor that in, that comes their report. Well, then you know what the baseline is for all of the future conversations. And then the last thing I'll say for the advisors out there who might not have worked with this very much, that ability to create your own personalized dashboard. But if you don't know this, you should learn it. If you can go in, you can go in and create kind of like 9 little widgets or 6 widgets that you can go in, different reports where you want to pull them. Also, because all your engineering clients want a dashboard. Even if you create it, they're going to have a better one, but that's not the point. The point is you've got one and let the monitor. So that is a very cool feature that 50% of the people who are listening to this podcast aren't using it or don't even know it exists. And so if you can put that together and make that a favorite on your clients along with what their favorite report is, you'll probably get better and gain.
A lot to chew on there. I just want to reinforce a couple of things. Number one, the decision center and our build out, I remember in 2013 when that thing came out and it just appeared one day, even for us internally, it just popped up and we were like, what is this advanced planning center thing? Yeah, basically. And now it's, the flagship product for eMoney. And I think the delivery of advice in there, I couldn't agree more that it helps visualize and personalize in a way that just it's a proactive tool. It's a reactive tool, but it definitely, I think, engages clients at exactly where they're at and helps deliver advice, but also kind of proactively engage new conversations, like some of the estate ones that you were bringing up. The 5-year cash flow is always a fan favorite for exactly the same reasons why you talked about, right? It's detailed enough for a long enough time period. And then you could always zoom back out if you want to look at the kind of whole picture. And then aspects of the client portal with the reports section. And then the plan summary report is the dashboard, I'm assuming the customized page. I totally agree. You'll just continue to give feedback and make sure that you move stuff around. Or are there any other key best practices, features, reports that you tend to lean towards quite a bit?
Well, I think inside the office, I think having... if you could have your younger advisors set up those scenarios on Decision Center, I think that's super helpful. They're most likely much better at doing it than you are anyway. And the idea is, that they get a chance to see what all those different options are for the client. The other thing I would say is don't just put in just the options that the client's going to consider. Put in some things in there that you think they might even say no to. Because the Decision Center shouldn't be a yes center. Should be no, that's not about us. We don't do that. Like, for instance, if a client's talking about making a gift, don't be afraid to put a larger gift in there as a potential decision maker. Don't let the client say that this is the amount and that be it. This is a virtual whiteboard that has no meaning at all until is agreed to by the client. And so I think it's really helpful to have that conversation both ways. If we want to look like, what does the world look like if inflation is higher than this? We also should look at what does the world look like if it's lower. And I know we all think we know the future, but is whatever we're looking at. If we're looking at high returns, we need to look at low. And if we're looking at high inflation, we should look at low. If we're looking at low expenses, we should say, well, what happens if we decide to really spend some more money? What does that look like, right? The decision maker and the decision center should be, in my mind, this upper bound and lower bound region with all these choices, right? It's like a menu at a fancy restaurant. You know, do I want to go with the, I've been here three times. Do I want to go with what I know is good, or am I ready to take the plunge and go for the special that I may like the online? And to me, that's what the decision center is all about. You know, so getting that point out. And until you get there, I don't think you get a seat at the table on those big decisions that clients are really thinking about. Well, do I give $18,000 a year to my kid now for the next 10 years? Or what if I give him $150,000 more? Yeah, those sorts of questions that we answer every day, and that are big questions, big meaningful questions, right? Is how much support do I provide my family today versus how much do I provide them with my debt? And here are all the other benefactors at the table when I make a decision. When I make a decision, who else wants? Do my kids win only? Does the IRS win? Who wins? Because that's always what people are kind of looking at. What was that? Okay, is this a win-win decision? Well, it might be, but is the other party that's winning the party that you want to win? And just those sorts of things. And I think that having a really robust setup where nothing's off the table on the decision center is super helpful. And you won't get there with everybody, but if you have somebody that's really open to it, don't be afraid to push the envelope, see where I'm at.
I think that's the beauty of financial planning, though, is the option to give them more options and let them decide with decision center. So I think that's really lovely. 25 years is a lot of advice and guidance. So a lot of handling the storm. What's the one thing that keeps you up at night as you think about our industry and helping your clients work through their concerns?
Oh, man, capacity. I guess, which part of the biggest one is being able to be available to give the solution when the problem presents itself. And whether that's me or whether that's the giant we, whether that's, me or Waverly, that's a worry. And I think to the extent that the Waverly merger, closes the books as an unquestioned success, that will be the fear that gets nowhere to most.
And hopefully we continue to enable from a tech partner perspective, that efficiency and capacity so that you can do your best work in actually delivering planning and building relationships with your clients. But we do have one last question that we ask every one of our guests, which is, how would you define the heart of advice when it comes to financial planning?
I told you guys, I thought I had an unusual answer to this question, but I may not, but so I think it's that communication level between the client and the advisor. And when I think about that, what I'm talking about is you can have a very healthy heart, but if you don't have any circulation within the body, it's not good. So you can have an advisor that has a lot of knowledge, but if there's no transfer of that knowledge to the client, it doesn't work. Does it matter how much the advisor knows? And conversely, if the client is in a situation where they don't trust the advisor or they don't feel comfortable enough to share up about what's going on in their world, the heart of advice fails when the circulation in advice falters. And the circulation in advice is not always from advisor to client. It's not always from client to advisor. I think of it as this kind of circular thing where, something new happens in the market and we're telling the client, hey, this is available now and it didn't used to be available. And I think it's perfect for you. And then the client gets to take that information and do what they will or really think through it. Or the client calls us up and says, hey, I just got a promotion or I've got this is an offer. I I can take 2 years severance, or I can keep working here, but they'll probably fire me anyway. And do you have, you know, 45 minutes to go through this work? And this is really important thing. Thinking about getting a second award. All these things that kind of meets that circulation of advice that I think is just critical to the heart of advice. And that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
James, as a daughter of a previous doctor, I love the idea of, you know, the heart and the circulation. And I just think that's a really wonderful and unique answer to end us on. So thank you for coming. Yes. But thank you, James, for being on. We've enjoyed you for sure.
The Heart of Advice podcast is produced by eMoney Advisor, a leading provider of technology solutions and services that help people talk about money. Learn more at eMoneyAdvisor.com, where you can find additional resources for advisor success, including the Heart of Advice blog, as well as eBooks, CE webinars, and events.